Nice. Okay. Thank you very much. I've let the genie out of the bottle. Okay. It's the thin end of the wedge there. No hope for me now. Nice. I'm sorry to interrupt. I am. It's a shame that we can't just have a nice big conversation, but it's a little difficult to manage with 300 people. So I'm going to talk for a while, and then we'll have some more conversation toward the end. As Dorothea said, I'm here to talk in more detail about some material that came up with Russell last week. For those of you that are at Said Business School, you may have heard some of this before. You will hear it again, so apologies for any overlap. And for all of you, everything I'm going to say is common sense. There is nothing particularly magic about this. I hope, though, that I will be able to package it in a way that seems relevant at any particular stage of the entrepreneurial journey that you might be on. So some of you will actually be in the middle of starting a business, of building a business, and that's why you're here. Some of you just have a dream. Some of you are badly scarred. And everything in between. So I hope that what I'm going to say is relevant at every stage of that. And additionally, some of you might be here because, let's say, your husband is an entrepreneur and you're trying to figure out what the hell he's doing all the time. I hope maybe this will be useful as well. It's about the full value chain of the of entrepreneurial activity. Okay. Always have a little techie problem. Right there. Now, this is a very plain vanilla theory for what entrepreneurship is, or more maybe how it happens. The idea being that when certain conditions align cluster together, you have a higher likelihood of entrepreneurial activity happening. And we certainly see all of these conditions in Oxford right now, and have done for a generation or more. Not to go into great detail, but basically where you have, for example, lots of clever people gathered together coming up with whizzy inventions, and they're connected to each other in some way, and they're connected to sources of money, and that doesn't necessarily mean cash. It can mean other types of money, like borrowing from banks. Where there are also people who have done good things before and a general cultural attitude and atmosphere that favors venturing or risk-taking or both, and some sort of coordinating element in the middle that informs people of the value of all these things and of how to keep them working together. And then finally, when you've made your company fairly successful and you sell it to someone and you get great big buckets of money, or you stay on as the chairman without having to worry too much about the day-to-day operations, or you manage to extricate yourself from it in some other way that you like. If all of those things are present and possible, then it's a favorable atmosphere for entrepreneurship. And that's exactly what we've got in Oxford. Even larger, it's exactly what we've got in this region of Great Britain, and at this particular period of time, when, let's face it, it's not so easy to get a normal job, there are a lot more incentives around some of these things. The cultural attitude favors taking a risk now because there's less at stake, for example. You're not giving up as much in a career path if you're not going to get a job anyway. There's actually quite a lot of money around in funny places. The government is actually showering money over early stage ventures right now because that costs less than propping up banks. There are lots of other sources of risk capital that are available now because it's a fairly likely way of getting a high return on that money, much more so than sticking in a bank and getting 0.5%. Interest or whatever the rate is right now. We're here as part of the education process trying to show you how these pieces fit together. And What I'm going to do is show you kind of how to look at these various ideas with a specific project in mind, and to decide whether that project is the right project for coordinating these favorable factors around you. And what I'm by implication also doing is showing you how to realize that your project might be, and in fact probably is, the wrong project. You need to learn the discernment in addition to handling your enthusiasm to be able to say, I've got a great idea, but actually it's not the right time for it. Or I've got a great idea, but I don't have the right people to make it happen just yet. Or I've got a great idea, and all I need to make it the right opportunity is X ingredient or Y ingredient. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about. All right. You all have in your minds an idea of what entrepreneurship is, but if anyone has looked into this more systematically, like perhaps as a student, you look at the definition of entrepreneurship, or you might sit through a class, a full term on entrepreneurship, you'll find that there's an enormous amount of variety in the way people define it. For example, here we, in the Saïd Business School, we tend to think of entrepreneurship as something quite broadly based, as a transferable skill or a mindset or an attitude that is useful in investment banking or in scientific research or in university administration, as much as it is starting a business or running a small venture. So this definition, which is one that I favor, encompasses both of those sides of the spectrum. Entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity beyond the resources currently controlled. And I'm going to take that as my theme for the rest of the talk. What word might you expect to be in a definition of entrepreneurship that is not here? For example, the word business. Nothing on there about business. So I could well be talking about any kind of venture. Renovating the Ashmolean Museum a few years ago was an entrepreneurial project, if ever there was one, because they had no resources. They went ahead and did it and figured out how to pay for it as they went along. So I'm not necessarily talking about business. That word is missing. What other word is missing from this that you might expect to find? Sorry? Risk, yeah. Profit. Finance. We have one more. Sorry. Value.
Idea.
Okay, yeah, these are all missing. They're all missing, and they're all important to entrepreneurship. And what I'm going to say is all of those words are contained within or subsets of the key word in here, which is opportunity. You need to understand what constitutes an opportunity by virtue of the balance of all those other things: risk, value, profit, idea, etc. And I'm going to give you a framework for sort of evaluating an idea to decide whether or not it really constitutes an opportunity. Because it is true that ideas are not the same as opportunities. People always come at me on a weekly basis with, "Ooh, I've got the best idea for a business." And it makes me groan inwardly. But I have learned how to sit them down and say, "Well, tell me more," up to the point where I can say, "I don't think this will fly." You need to look at it from this angle more in order to decide whether you really want to pursue this. An idea is something that we all have all the time. We all have ideas all the time. We have them in the shower before we've woken up in the morning. We have them when we're cycling along. We have them when we're talking with other people as well as when we're on our own. Ideas are easy to have. But when you apply a little critical thinking to an idea, which is something that we're all getting better at by virtue of being engaged in whatever else we're doing here in Oxford and Oxford University and Saïd Business School, when you start to really press on an idea, you begin to limit it and say, given these constraints, is this still compelling? And you're beginning to shape an opportunity out of that idea. So, when we say something like, the time is right for this idea, we're defining it in a moment, in a specific moment, and saying it won't work then, and it won't work even further in the future. It has to happen now. That's saying that there are certain resources or certain factors that must align in order for this idea to be good, and they happen to be aligning now. If we don't seize the moment, it will perish. Or we need to know exactly how to seize the moment in order to capture the value from it. Now let me try to illustrate this more concretely. Here are some ideas, here are some opportunities, here are some things that are quite ambiguous. So it's a great idea to cure cancer. Anyone want to argue with that? Great idea. Has anyone figured out how to do it yet? Now, I think you've got the point. That's the point. That's the only point. Don't come to me and say, oh, I've got a great idea for a business, if you can't follow through with it and really make it into a real thing. Cold fusion, wonderful. I love the sound of that. And I'll just sit back and wait until it happens again. People keep saying they've done it, but it never seems to happen. No one's ever commercialized that or repeated the processes that have been identified in the past as cold fusion. Now, on the other hand, let's talk about budget airlines. We've all flown in a budget airline, EasyJet, Jet Airways in India, Southwest in the US. 15 years ago, anyone fly a budget airline 15 years ago? Maybe Southwest Airlines in the States, but not in the UK. They were just coming up. Ryanair actually existed, but it was not the thing it is now. So what changed 15, 18 years ago that allowed the idea of flying from here to Malmö and thinking you're going to Stockholm and paying 1p and not having to bring your own seat on the plane, what changed between now and then that made that such a compelling business proposition? I'm not asking for an answer, because I don't really know. But the point is, something did change. Something did change that allowed that idea, that business model, to come into its own. There were negative reasons and positive reasons, problems with conventional air travel, problems with rail travel, benefits with a disposable income, patterns of business expenditure, and efficiencies inside the operations of an actual airline and the ability to maximize the load on the plane that were finally figured out. All of those things contributed to make that the right opportunity. But anyone who tried to get 100 people from Stansted to Malmö in 1980 would have lost his shirt. And now Michael Leary, or whatever his name is at Ryanair, is ferociously wealthy because he figured out the difference between that idea and the opportunity, which was Ryanair. Does anyone know what a cotton gin is? Anyone here from the States, the U.S.? A respectable few. What's a cotton gin? Give me a three-word definition of a cotton gin. Oh, you're all so young. This used to be the thing that everyone knew in grade school because it was a sort of major technological innovation that came along after the U.S. Civil War sort of reignited the economy. What is it?
I can't do it in three words.
Ten.
It separates cotton from the seeds.
It combs the seeds out of the cotton fibers, which was a very labor-intensive activity until someone, a guy named Eli Whitney, invented this machine. Now, he had actually invented it some 10, 15 years earlier, and in fact, other people had come up with similar technologies for combing the seeds out of cotton in the 1850s. But the idea never went anywhere. The idea never went anywhere. And that's not necessarily because Eli Whitney or the other inventors were stupid or had something wrong with the device. The devices that came before the cotton gin were all essentially the same. Why did the cotton gin not take off before the time when it did take off? Any ideas? I can give a one-word answer to this one. Slavery. Slavery. That's the answer. It's not a funny answer. It's an actual and depressing answer. There was a labor force in place that did what cotton gins did and cost less. All right. So until that was removed from the system and various other factors were added, there was no point in commercializing that innovation. It was a great idea, but not a good opportunity. Now, there are a lot of things that are ambiguous, not so obvious. And certainly the cotton gin wasn't even obvious in its time, or budget airlines wasn't obvious in its time. Twitter. Does anyone know how profitable Twitter is as a company? It's not. It doesn't make much, if any, money. Eventually, I think fairly soon, someone will figure this out, that there's a lot of money to be made there. There's obviously a lot of value happening. It's very entrepreneurial. It's an astonishing innovation, but more in terms of social forces and modes of communication and the way it adds or lubricates other types of technologies. In and of itself, it's not a commercialized, profitable venture. And that's not a problem. It's still in identifying it as entrepreneurial. But if what you're trying to do is make some money, the model that Twitter's got is probably not the way to go. Clean coal. We can do it. We can burn coal and have very few emissions. But what's the problem? Why don't we do it all the time if we can? What's the problem? Too expensive. Too expensive. And where do you put all the stuff you take out of the emissions? You're not really cleaning it up 100% because that stuff still has to go somewhere. So there are not enough benefits in the right place at the right time for it to constitute an actual opportunity for commercialization. Now, there might be. We might figure out how to do clean coal before we get comfortable with nuclear power again, or before solar is broadly affordable, or before some other innovation comes along. And at that time, we'll see more opportunities emerging around entrepreneurial ventures dealing with clean coal. But for the moment, it's ambiguous. So I'm not saying that distinguishing between an idea and an opportunity is easy. It takes a lot of work. It's not common sense. It's not obvious. But the mental exercise that goes into figuring out the difference and deciding whether you've got an opportunity worth pursuing, though laborious, it consists of many fairly easy parts that all of you can do. So let me start turning to what they may be. Broadly speaking, what you're doing is looking for patterns. Broadly speaking, what you're doing is trying to find some sort of consistency that isn't obvious to other people. And that consistency might be in efficiency terms. It might be in demand, who and how many people want your product. It might be in your ability to organize the sources of input into your product better than someone else. To use that to constitute your opportunity. More specifically, though, there are other ways of thinking about it, and let's look at them. Another way of making a distinction between a venture worth pursuing and one that probably isn't is to think along the lines of these patterns and how much you can influence them, how much you can manage or control a situation and other people's perceptions of it. You may have some sort of inspirational entrepreneurial vision, but without an ability to kind of organize and control at some level, or to have help in doing that, you're probably not going to be able to gather together the resources necessary for pursuing that opportunity. I'm not going to go into great detail about this because we're a little bit behind time, but the basic point is that there needs to be more than just an idea, more than just vision, and you can either call that an ability to see patterns or gather resources or manage and control them. It's all essentially the same. Here's yet another way of looking at it, and because we're in a business school, I have to at some point put things into a 2x2 matrix, so I've gone ahead and done that for you here. Are you thinking about your idea, or are you thinking about how to control the resources necessary to realize it? Now, let's talk a bit about the people inside these boxes. Why is the inventor here? Someone who has low focus on opportunity and low ability in managing things. I'll explain, and then maybe you can think through the others. Someone who invents something doesn't really care about seeing it go through its commercialization process. She's probably more interested in having invented it, or in moving on to the next invention. Or perhaps she's got just some sort of joy in creativity and not wanting to go through the process of seeing it develop further. There are a lot of people like this in universities and around universities. They're the ones that are utterly essential for generating ideas, but not necessarily the people you need for turning those ideas into more developed opportunities. Because, very often, their ability to manage the process of getting further along is low. Now, people who are really good at managing things, but not so great at having whizzy ideas, they tend to end up as bank managers, or helping other people, like inventors, organize the resources, and together they can push towards making something happen. On the opposite side of the scale, you've got an entrepreneur who is someone that is actually aware of this difference between an idea and an opportunity, who knows what it takes to gather the resources necessary to pursue that opportunity. May not have total control over those resources, but can gather it together. And the sort of ideal people are the ones that can lead that process from beginning to end. They're very hard to find, and they usually work actually in groups rather than singly. But we won't go into that now. So I've just represented this difference between idea and opportunity in various different ways, verbally, visually, structurally, and I hope the point is now very obvious, that it takes more than just a good idea to get somewhere, I hope that now we can move in more detail to what exactly more you do need. I get a lot of questions from people, especially in the business school context, who say, I really want to work in an entrepreneurial environment, but I don't have an idea. I know what you're saying. I get that there's a role for me and my managerial skill, but I don't know anyone with good ideas, or I don't know how to tell whether all those good ideas that I see in the chemistry faculty or in the climate change research unit, I don't know how to evaluate which of them is any good. Nor do I even really know where all these ideas are coming from. Here's a little hint about where ideas are coming from. And if you're thinking along these lines, then that's great. That's your first step. You're starting to move in the right direction. You've got an idea that might be plausible. First of all, large-scale trends. This much should be pretty obvious. If you can identify and prove the momentum behind a trend that's really a trend, then you're on to something. Now, so for example, let's go back to the budget airline thing. There were a lot of reasons why that was going to go for a while. A lot of reasons having to do with demographics, with the other types of communication or transport infrastructure being inadequate. Reasons that would allow a relatively new development to go for a long time. Experience or observation. If you see something that works or that doesn't work, and you understand how to translate that into a different context ahead of somebody else, it's a good idea. That's sort of the simplest kind of idea, a new and better mousetrap. Research. So many of you in this room are engaged in research or are adjacent to cutting-edge research, so you've got a real advantage over people in other contexts that I sometimes speak to. Especially when it comes to science, which is, of course, so difficult for people without extensive and expensive training to replicate, where you can, with research, enter into an area where there is clear need, where there is pain, where there is suffering, where there is something that your technology or your process can address directly and be patented for, then obviously your research has the potential to be commercializable. And then finally, where you see a model that works in a discrete and different place that you can move or adapt and move into your place, that's another source of good ideas. Starbucks is the classic example of this. People in Europe, and particularly Southern Europe, have been drinking coffee forever. My people in America only just discovered this about 20 years ago. It's hard to believe, but somehow it took a while. Once they figured it out, adapted it for local tastes and processes, then that idea turned into an opportunity. Okay. Roughly speaking, these are the four places that good ideas come from. If you can't substantiate your idea in one of these ways, you're probably not talking about a good idea. You're probably talking about a daft idea, a dumb idea. So this is sort of the first triage that you can go through in your head. Now, I'm going to give you a different kind of triage, assuming you've got a good idea, and now you want to really stress test it and make sure it's not just a good idea, but also a good opportunity. This is basically it. I'm going to explore the five zones on this model in the remaining 15 minutes. Okay. First of all, here's a question. What's the difference, to put it bluntly, what's the difference between a market and an industry? The answer is right up on the board. A market is what people want, and an industry is all of the people who provide it. Now, we tend to use these terms wrongly. We tend to use market and industry interchangeably. It doesn't matter. Everyone kind of knows what you mean when you use the words. But for the purposes of this analysis, think more carefully about demand and supply. To the extent that you can understand the demand for whatever your idea is and understand how it might be met by other people or other actors in this system, you are beginning to understand whether you have something to add that's new and defensible. Anyone see this film, The Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams, Kevin Costner, drippy, drippy film from the mid-80s, full of whinging people. The basic tagline, if you build it, they will come. Well, I can't even remember the plot. He built a baseball field, a baseball pitch, right in the middle of the Iowa cornfields. He destroys his crop to put in a great big diamond for people to play baseball in the middle of an economic recession, in a town with fewer people than would constitute two baseball teams. But he's got a vision, and he's going to do it. And in fact, there are ghostly voices in the night saying to him, if you build it, they will come. So he builds it. He plows out an acre or two of his cornfield and builds the thing, and all these people start playing baseball and everyone's happy, and then the movie's over. Okay. So does that sound realistic to you? It does not sound realistic to me, and in fact it is not realistic. It's Hollywood, and it's a myth. But every time I turn around, someone says, you know, I've got this great idea, no one's ever heard of it before, but when they do, they'll know how brilliant it is. So I'm going to go ahead and build it right now. I'm going to mortgage my house. I'm going to take all of my wife's savings, and I'm going to build this prototype, and I'm going to sell it, and we're going to be rich. No, you're not. I can tell you that with 100% certainty, because you're moving too fast. The people will realize how special it is thing is 100% wrong. Here's another myth. No one's ever done this before. No one's ever done this before. So what? Do you think there might be a really good reason why no one's done it before? Because it's pointless. There's no point in having a fork like that. It won't do anything. No one's ever done it before, but it's pointless. Similarly, if it looks like a duck, and it floats like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, but it's battery operated, it's not a duck. So if what people want is a duck, and you're giving them something that's never been done before, but they don't want it, then it's no good. It's not an opportunity. It's a dumb idea. Let's see how you can tell whether what you're thinking is stupid or smart. Think about just the four quadrants right now. I want to plot to you, as I showed earlier briefly, demand and supply on one axis and these two other terms on the other. Let's look at the top left, where we're looking at demand in a particular context. Remember I said that good ideas come from trends. How do you know whether you've got a trend? Well, you can measure. You can go to the library, you can go to the internet, and you can measure things. You can say, 2 years ago, there were X thousand people buying products of this sort, or there were X million people with this particular disease, or there was a demonstrable evidence of X size of demand for some sort of solution along the lines that I've got in mind. And what's more, that was 2 years ago, and now there's been 60% growth in just 24 months. Or there has been enough growth that I think will continue, and I can, even if I sell a tiny bit, I can sell more in the following year rather than less. Okay? And incidentally, at this point I should say, by sell, I don't necessarily mean sell at a profit. I generally do, but we could be talking about something that you're selling for on a non-profit basis, or that you just want people to use. So, for example, a lot of museums calculate the success of their operation by saying, 2 years ago we had 100 people coming through the door every day, now we have 150, next year we're projecting 180, we're going to make some innovations to make sure those numbers keep going up. So we can be talking on those terms just as much as selling widgets. So if you can say that the demand, given the context, is positive and getting bigger, then you're probably onto something. If you can also say that there's something about the industry, something about all the other people who are trying to meet this demand that's favorable. Basically, there are a lot of people in the world who drink coffee, and now we've figured out where to get a lot of coffee and how to get it to every single street corner in the developed world. Coffee is a supply chain that works. You're not trying to sell some sort of exotic pawpaw juice with little umbrellas on every street corner in the world. That would be hard because there are not enough pawpaws or little umbrellas. It would be hard to get a hold of all of that for anyone, not just you. There are general structural conditions in the industry around the idea that you have that favor your ability to do it. Let's go down a level, at a more micro level, when you're in contact with the customer or the user. When you're in contact with the customer, is their demand so great that they will, in fact, pay you for it? Can you prove this? Can you say, yes, people will swap cash for my product? Yes, they will. And moreover, I know why. It's because they're in pain, or because they can't get it from anywhere else, or because mine is, in fact, different in a way that they value, or innovative in a way that they value. If you can explain that people really will buy something and why, then, again, you're probably onto something. And then finally, ask this question. In contact with your customer, will they buy your product, or will they buy someone else's? Or will they buy something else that's similar? So, for example, with EasyJet, can you fly from Stansted Airport to Paris on EasyJet? None of you has checked this out? You don't want to go to Paris? How do you go to Paris? How do you get from here to Paris? Train! So why would you waste your money on an airplane? And why would EasyJet waste its money on a route from Greater London to Paris? They won't. There's a substitute product. Now, that doesn't mean they can't operate in another environment, but they don't bother trying to pretend or substantiate an opportunity in flying from London to Paris. So there is another way, and they've stayed out of that. If you can answer all these questions in a way that favors your idea, and you can provide evidence for it, even if it's not necessarily massively strong evidence, then you're definitely on your way to proving that what you've got is an opportunity and not just an idea. Okay. Here is a more detailed checklist for how to kind of fill in the blanks in the boxes. And I won't go through that because I've already done it, but this is available on the slides to which you're all, you all have access through the system. Now, let me talk about the middle zone, the bubble in the middle that I've called resources. And in many ways, this is far and away the most important because it's the hardest to gather evidence for, and it's also the hardest to manage as a process. There are three elements to it. Resources, very broadly conceived. It doesn't mean how much money you have or how much inventory you've got or how many nuts and bolts you've got or people to assemble them. Not just that, at any rate. It means some of the fancier things, like, for example, A, attitude to risk. You yourself and the people you're working with, are you comfortable working in such an uncertain environment? Are you jazzed up by it or scared by it or something in between, which incidentally is the norm? If it's anxiety-provoking for you or a large part of your team to operate in the environment that you're operating in, you've got a problem. Isn't that obvious? But way too many people fail to ask that early on. They ride on their own enthusiasm and can't drag along with them the other people that they need at the same level of enthusiasm. And somewhere along the line, the attitude to risk in the team as a whole is tipping the wrong way. Like with attitude, sheer ability is often hard to match to requirements. Do you have everything that you need to execute on your idea? If it's something to do with operating in Iceland, do you know how to do that? Or do you know how to find people who know how to do that? Or when you need them, can you find them? Or more concretely, have you got a good accountant or a good lawyer or whatever else it might be? Have you got a clear sense of what the abilities are that are necessary and some ability to control them? If you don't, do you have the networks that can bring those things to you or through which you can go find them? Remembering that entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity beyond the resources you currently control, it also is pursuing opportunity through your networks to resources that you don't control, but other people do, and you know who they are. So again, if you don't have any money to pay a lawyer, can you find someone who'll help you out for free or on some other basis? Or if you don't have the right one ingredient, the last thing that you need to make your the brownies that you're selling, do you know how to find it in sufficient quantity at the right price through the networks that you have? If you can answer all of these things in a positive way, then you're on to a good thing. If you can't, if any one of them is a problem, it will probably collapse the whole system. Any one of these things can be a fatal flaw. It'll be a different thing for every single idea, what might or might not be the fatal flaw, but any one of them can knock the whole thing over. So you have to think about all of them, at least at some intuitive level, and gather evidence at some level that you can communicate with others that you've satisfied yourself that everything's going to be okay. Okay, now I just want to spend maybe 3 or 4 minutes on the subtle stuff around attitude, because that really, as I say, is the hardest to quantify, hardest to prove. Do you have the right attitude to risk? Do you have the ability to achieve? Do you have the networks? When people like venture capitalists or investment bankers even, anyone looking at a new venture, at a proposal, is trying to evaluate that proposal and decide whether they want to put money behind it or other effort or support behind it. These are the kinds of questions they're asking, not is this a whiz-bang technology. They're far more interested in the people side of things than in than the other stuff. Is there some element of leadership in the team or the group of people, even if it's not reposing in one person, it can be distributed among many, that will deliver on those softer things, the ability, the attitude to risk, the ability to achieve, and the networks? Investors ask questions like this. So if you can figure out how to answer them, then you're, again, moving rapidly towards being able to prove that you have an idea, you have an opportunity instead of just an idea. There's some other things that you want to prove you don't have, or that you're not battling with, or that are not going to become a problem and trip you up eventually. And these are things, again, that people look for, particularly investors or people who want to join entrepreneurial teams and contribute to them, are often either subliminally or consciously aware of. It's basically bad behavior of one sort or another. We have this idea in our minds that entrepreneurship is a sort of heroic, macho activity, that one guy, one sort of Richard Branson, is going to take control of everything. And it's almost never true. It's, I think you can tell from everything else I'm saying, a matter of coordination, of group activity, of collaborative activity, of shared endeavor. And if there's too much of a center, it can destabilize and demotivate everybody else. One of the biggest distinguishing factors between a great idea and a viable opportunity is the people, plural, making it happen. So don't think you have to go it alone. Find people to help you, appropriate people, and make sure others know that you're engaged in that activity, because without it, you're probably never going to have the energy or indeed the ability to assemble all the things you need in order to make it happen. All right. There are other ways of deciding whether you've got what it takes that you can just ask simple questions. And again, I won't go through these because I've already said it, and they're on the slides. But think about your ability, your attitude, and various contextual factors along the lines that I have described in this framework. And you'll begin to be able to assess whether what you're doing is viable or not. So just to sum it up into one simple sentence, a good idea is just the beginning. Thinking about that idea in a structure like this, and there are many others that are similar, will allow you to decide whether to put the time and effort that's necessary into really developing it as an opportunity. I hope that every one of you has got something to work with and will run it through a filter like this in a thoughtful way, so that in a few years' time we'll find 300 highly successful entrepreneurs sitting here, and I'll be here to congratulate you. Thanks for your attention.